interests me to talk about today, which maybe it's not the same thing that interests some of you, I've heard rumors, is the factor of investigation, which is an important element of mindfulness practice. And this morning at breakfast, my wife asked me what I was going to speak about today, and I said, investigation. She said, oh, it's a good thing you're giving the talk at the end of the day. Because the subject of investigation, it lends itself to becoming excessively thoughtful about the experience, kind of thinking about it and exploring it. And investigation is an active side of mindfulness practice. And a lot of people, that's a side of practice they have the most trouble with anyway. They're overly active. And the more quiet, receptive side, or the calming side, the tranquilizing side of practice, is a side which for many people is the side that needs to be encouraged or strengthened or discovered. But in any case, it's what I want to talk about. I hope it works. Interesting for you. The factor of investigation is one of the seven factors belonging to a list in Buddhism called the Seven Factors of Awakening, Seven Factors of Enlightenment. But I like the word awakening because I suspect many of us, when we use the word, especially when we use it as synonymous with enlightenment, we take it to be a noun. Awakening as being a thing. But awakening can also be seen as an activity, as a verb. And I think that's more the spirit of Buddhist idea of awakening. It's not a done deal. It's not like this final one particular kind of experience that you can aim for and then get and then hang on to or refer back to all the time. And this is I had this at one point and this is really great. But it's an ongoing activity, an ongoing action of awakening, of awakening oneself, of being awakened constantly. One of the terms in Buddhism, there's different kinds of awakening in Buddhism. But one of the kinds is called non-abiding awakening. Awakening which doesn't abide anywhere, which doesn't rest anywhere, doesn't get established anywhere, doesn't say, oh, this is it now. Now I got it. Or doesn't incline itself towards a particular place as being, this is the place, this is what awakening is like. Any description of awakening, thing that can be experienced that might be a kind of like an awakening becomes a fixed thing if we abide in it. And the point of freedom is not to abide anywhere, but have the freedom to move freely to new experiences, to new appropriate responses to activities. And from this point of view, I think of mindfulness practice, I think of Buddhist practice, awakening practice, as being a practice that discovers flexibility. And that flexibility is a very important quality. To have a mind, a heart, a body, a way of responding and living in the world that is flexible to all the changing conditions and permutations. And if we look at the point of Buddhist practice, or the point of mindfulness practice to be flexibility, I think we end up with a lot safer spiritual practice than if we say that the point of the practice is X, or the point is B, or the point is to have certain kind of state, or certain kind of experience, or certain kind of wisdom, or understanding. As soon as it's reified, as soon as it becomes a thing, it becomes fragile, actually. The only thing which is not fragile is flexibility. The only thing which is not rigid is flexibility. So the point is, in a sense, to stay flexible. And that means in all different ways. But a lot has to do with understanding appropriateness, appropriate responses in given situations. If we come with preconceived ideas about what our response should be, then we don't have the flexibility to be adaptable to the appropriate situation. And you see that a lot in mindfulness practice, where people have some fixed idea of what it is. And I'm a classic case of this. When I came back, I did this 8-month-long retreat in Burma. And when you do a long Vipassana retreat, the tendency is to do things really slowly. And so you don't just simply pick up, a striker. You're aware of the desire or the intention to pick up the striker. and then you're aware of the signal, kind of to let your hand go out and reach for it, and you're aware of actually the fingers uncurling and the arm going forward, and the tightening that happens and the loosening that happens, and then the contact and maybe the temperature of the striker, and then the intention and desire to kind of actually put your hands around it, and then the intention to kind of lift it and the pulling and the tightening that happens. And you know, it takes a long time. Now, and you might wonder, what's the point of this? You know, it's kind of like... But in any case, you do things very, very slowly to do things very mindfully. And it's actually quite a wonderful practice because it develops a familiarity, intimacy, acute concentration that is very hard to develop any other way. So I did that for 8 months, which is, you know... So when I came back to America, I thought that was the way you're supposed to be mindful. You know, you have to do everything kind of intending to reach for the doorknob, touching the doorknob, twisting the doorknob, opening the doorknob. You know, and the people behind me waiting to get through the door. You know, and so it took me a little few weeks after coming back to America to realize that mindfulness in the context of our normal life, you know, here in the West, it wasn't like being on retreat all the time. And I had to kind of relax. And because I wasn't actually so relaxed anymore. I was relaxed on the retreat in Burma. I was relaxed enough doing all this stuff. But trying to maintain this way of being mindful in daily life was not what was called for. It was not the way to be mindful. And here, mindfulness was more of a kind of a general, wider sense of being present for the wider kind of activity and not the minute details of what was going on. So it was an example of, me not being so flexible, or knowing how to be flexible with seeing the discovering what was appropriate, what was my appropriate response was given the condition and situation I was in. So to be flexible, do we have the flexibility to move back and forth? To sometimes I'd be very precisely detailed with the mindfulness, sometimes be very spacious in general. Do we have the appropriateness to know when to investigate the situation carefully versus when to kind of surrender to the situation and surrender to the activity and kind of almost, in a sense, maybe even lose a kind of reflective ability in certain situations? You know, you go out to the basketball court to play basketball, and if you're too reflective, if you're kind of like intending to throw, or if you're too reflective, you know, about what you're doing, it's not really the place and time to do that. And there's a way of just kind of, you to play basketball well, you have to know the kind of basic idea of the game and have a little bit of skill and then abandon yourself to it. And that's what's appropriate in that situation. So knowing what's appropriate in different situations is part of, and then being flexible enough to flow back and forth. There's a lot of what we're learning, I think, in Buddhism is the flexibility, not a particular state of being. So in Buddhism, this is called a non-abiding awakening. An awakening which doesn't abide, doesn't settle anywhere. Now I got it. As soon as you say, now I've got it, that moment, you've lost it. So it's very tricky. There's this thing in biology where, maybe it's changed now, but it used to be, that... when they were going to dissect a cell, as soon as you cut into the cell would die. So you can never you can never actually go into a cell with a microscope or whatever and see what a living cell was like, because as soon as you cut it, you'd kill it. And it's something like that sometimes with our own life. As soon as you say, now I got it, you've lost it. And so there's a certain kind of reflectivity which actually gets in the way, even though mindfulness is a kind of reflectivity. I call it, what gets in the way is retroactive reflectivity. There is a place in life for that also. We have to be flexible and allow that also. But retroactive reflectivity, we're thinking back in time what just happened. You know, at that moment, we're settled on one thing, and the non-abiding awakening, which is really the continuing, allowing yourself to continue to flow with the changes of the present moment. So I was wondering why I even wrote notes for a talk. See, if I used my notes, then I'd be stuck, right? and rather flowing, non-abiding Dharma talk. Some of you might be wishing that I stayed with my notes closer. So awakening, these seven factors of awakening, this the verb, the activity of awakening, there are seven factors to this. And these seven factors are mindfulness, is the most important one. And then in either side of mindfulness, the next six are divided into two categories. And you don't have to memorize all six, but you should know the two general categories. On one side, there's those which are called the calming or tranquilizing factors. And the other side are those factors which are called energizing factors. And you need to have a balance of both. And these have to be balanced. Now, in the calming category, there are such things as equanimity, as concentration, and calm itself. On the energizing or engaging factors, there are investigation, rapture, and energy or effort or engagement itself. So as a person practices, one of the things that we can become aware of, and we will at some point, maybe not now, but as practice matures, it becomes natural sooner or later to naturally become aware. Not you're looking for it because you think, awakening is where it's at, so you better find the factors of awakening. But rather, naturally kind of arises is these seven factors, and they start having an important role in a person's meditation experience. Most of the time, we're dealing with hindrances, the five hindrances. But as the five hindrances abate and become not such an important part of our daily experience or normal experience, then the seven factors of awakening become increasingly important. And you will start seeing how these play. Joy has a role, and you can't really become awakened without there being some joy there. Awakening and joy are not synonymous necessarily, but and you can't really have concentration or calm without some. You can't really have concentration without some sense of calm or some sense of ease. You can get concentrated anxiously, but it's not really the kind of concentration we're looking for. So all these factors begin to coming into play, and one of them that's very important is investigation. Investigation is particularly useful if you find yourself being lethargic or complacent or dull in your mindfulness practice. One way to get a little bit more enlivening in your practice is to investigate more thoroughly, because investigation is one of the energizing factors of practice. However, what we don't want to do is tinker a lot. And maybe that's why my wife said you should give this talk. It's good you're giving this talk at the end of the day. The practice is so easy for many of us to be tinkering with our practice, to try to manipulate our practice and our experience, and try to make it different than what it is. So when I was sitting in Burma, my teacher Upandita, he never tinkered with anything. He was a purist as far as mindfulness was. And all mindfulness practice was recognizing what was happening in the moment, and then the next moment, and then the next moment. And that's what it was like. And you just recognized, you didn't try to adjust anything or fix anything or use antidotes. If you're angry, you didn't try to use loving kindness to feel better. You just simply stayed mindful of what was happening in the present moment, kind of uncompromisingly. This is what you were doing. And that was great. And I kind of thrived under his guidance there. But then I went to practice at Barry with some of the famous teachers there at IMS. And I noticed that when they went for interviews with them, they kept wanting to give me little pieces of advice. Why don't you try this? Do this. Upandita would never tell me anything to do. He'd just listen, and occasionally he would ask me to kind of report a little bit more accurately what happened. He said, you weren't accurate enough reporting what went on. Or, you know, or sometimes he would say, good, you know, that's, you're doing well, you know. Or carry, mostly, he never said that, maybe never. When he was pleased with you, he would say, carry on. Then you knew you were on the right track. And but the teachers at Berry, I'd report what was happening with me. And they'd say, okay, now try doing this little thing here, or try this little thing. And I, after a few interviews of this kind of, you know, interference in my practice, I told them, you look, hey, wait a minute, stop tinkering with me. You know, I'm just here to pay attention, to be mindful. And you're kind of telling me to do this and that. So they backed off. Until at some point during the retreat, these seven factors of awakening became very strong for me. And they became the main thing that I was kind of paying attention to. And you can feel sometimes how, you know, the balance between them. You can feel, you know, they're kind of, maybe the image is like, you know, in your stereo set, you have these seven, what are they called, the balancers, or they're kind of
equalizers.
And you can kind of, you can have this knob, you can kind of play with it to get different sounds, and, you know, and you can get them really, you know, and in my stereo set, you can hit different buttons, and there's the jazz version, and there's the rock version, is a classical kind of option, and it kind of changes the way those little lights, you know, I don't know what it does to the sound, but it changes the... Well, so it's like that. You have seven of these, and so you can feel how they're, you know, equal. So I'm starting to equalize them. So they're, all of them are equal, you know, equal strength. And so I started, you know, playing with them, you know, and I need a little more energy here, a little more investigation, and I need a little more calm now, or, you know, whatever. And I was kind of like just trying to get them just right. And I would go and report and tell my teachers. And after a few interviews of this, they told me, Gil, stop tinkering. So it's very important, you know, not to tinker too much. So the instructions and investigation is not so much to tinker, or not so much to try to change your experience or adjust your meditation and be more successful at it, but really an invitation to, or an effort to try to understand a little bit better what's actually happening in the present moment. So the basic idea, as I said this morning, with mindfulness, is it's to allow our experience to be as it is, to allow our experience to be as it is, while we're being consciously aware, consciously attentive, consciously conscious of what that experience is. So the allowing part is this great spacious field, great spaciousness of letting things be as they are. And again, it's allowing things to be as they are. It belongs to this part of practice of flexibility, this side of not abiding in any place, but allowing things to, you know, change and move as they wish. So it means also, in a sense, being a little bit at ease, some modicum, some sense of ease with what's happening. Even when you feel anxious and upset and terrible and traumatized, or, you know, that happens when we sit sometimes. Our whole life comes to us when we sit. But to have some ease about even being anxious, about even being afraid, or even being whatever it might be. And then with that sense of ease, then there can be sometimes investigation of our experience. But if we don't have some modicum of ease, some modicum of allowance, then the investigation can just feed into our attempts to try to control or manipulate or tinker or change or resist whatever's going on. So to investigate, one of the definitions or descriptions of investigation is a radiance of mind. And that doesn't seem like a very useful, maybe that's nice for poetry, you might say. But I like it because it's kind of like you turn on a light in a dark room and then you look around and see what's there. It's not like you're looking for something or probing or digging when you investigate. It's more like, well, what's going on here? You kind of look around. And this is particularly important when you find yourself in your meditation practice becoming calm And some people identify calm with being, they got it, or this is it, or this is the, you know, I finally deserve it, or this is really great. Now just, I'll hold everything in place. Please, no one sneeze. or the teachers are sitting up there. Please don't say anything in the middle of the sitting, because that would really, you know, I'm calm now, and don't disturb me. And then he says, okay, follow your breath. Come back to your breath. Oh, that guy, how could he, you know? Now, who's disturbing who then? Who's disturbing who? So when you do find yourself calm, or one of the ways to use that, in a sense, in meditation practice, is not to rest there, not to abide there, but rather to use that calm place to start to look around the room. What is the calm like? What is going on here while I'm calm? Being careful that the investigation doesn't agitate you, you know, you're not thinking about it or figuring things out, but rather just simply calmly kind of looking around. What's going on here? To get to know that space better, to get to know something about it better. So you're calm, and what is the breath like when you're calm? And get to know that really well, kind of look at that more carefully, or whatever the experience might be. Maybe I should look at my notes. Let's see if I have anything. So investigation is kind of like asking the question, what's going on now? And repeatedly kind of with a sense, or the inner sense, or the inner question, what's going on now, without expecting an answer. I think that's the spirit of it. Something might appear, and you might realize, oh, this is what's going on. But you have this alertness of the mind, this curiosity of mind. What is happening here right now? Not even expecting an answer to that. So this alertness of mind. What's going on here? And I believe that when we get more and deeply, sensitively in touch with ourselves, that inquiry, inquiring into what's going on, has more integrity to it, more integrity in terms of our inner life, than a state of calm or a state of peace, any particular state of being. Because inquiry is not a state. So, for example, if you're sitting here and you are calm and someone sneezes or the door opens and you get kind of rattled for a moment and say, oh, you know, how could someone walk in, you know, in the middle of a sitting, or how could someone sneeze, you know, or now you feel kind of, you know, whatever, and you're kind of agitated. And so you try to come back, oh, I've been distracted, I'm going to try to get back to this calm state I had. I don't think that's a movement of flexibility. I don't think that's a movement of freedom, of awakening. I think a movement of awakening would be simply to allow that to happen. This is what's happening next. To have the flexibility not to hold on to any one thing, even your own calm, but to recognize, oh, the door opened, I'm now a little bit more agitated, and then to be mindful of that. From the point of view of investigation, when that's appropriate, is to investigate what is actually going on here now that the door opened. What's going on within me? Am I afraid? Am I anxious? Am I angry because I've lost my state of calm? Do I have an expectation that calm is where it's at? You kind of look around, what is this state like? And my suggestion to you is that it has more integrity for inner life to do that investigation than it is to hurry back to some state of calm. That actually to hurry back to some state that seems ideal to you, actually I don't think it doesn't really represent our innermost integrity, our innermost wholeness, our innermost movement to freedom. Because freedom is non-abiding. And I think investigation belongs to this area of this aspect of non-abiding. One of the definitions, or one of the descriptions of investigation as a factor of awakening, is to investigate and to understand what is and what is not the path. This is a technical description. What is and what isn't the path? The path to freedom, or the path to awakening as a verb. to have some sense of what activity, inner activity, moves us towards flexibility, to freedom, and what inner activity moves us towards being increasingly preoccupied or in bondage or stuck or attached or fixated. In the simplest description, that's the division. That's the fork in the road between knowing what is the path and what is not. That fixation or attachment doesn't bring us, is not the path. The path is the movement towards the ability to be flexible, the movement towards not holding on, not being attached to anything. So investigation, well, part of what investigation is to begin seeing moment to moment that divide, that division, that choice that arises each moment between abiding someplace, fixating on something perhaps, and being free. And one place that it's very fascinating to investigate this is with a mind that wanders away. Now, if the mind wanders away in distraction or in preoccupation, and it takes you 5 minutes or 10 minutes to realize that you've been distracted the last 10 minutes, then the practice is simply to recognize where you're at when you wake up and then maybe come back to the breath. But sometimes when you're somewhat settled and calm in your practice, you can pay careful attention to just what it's like just as you begin to wander away in some kind of distraction. Because there's a qualitative difference inside of us between when we're not wandering away and when we are. Because when we're wandering away, a part of us, maybe it's a very small part of us, has gotten hooked onto something, has gotten preoccupied or fixated on something. And when it's gotten hooked on something or fixated on something, then that part of you is not free, is not flexible. And if the path is to stay flexible, if the path is to stay open and not be attached to anything, you can walk, you can see that happening right there in the moment. When you're in the present moment, and when you start leaving it, when you start leaving into some preoccupation. And if you can catch it right there and stay flexible, stay in the present moment, not allow yourself to wander down a trail of preoccupation, of being attached to some concern, you start finding yourself, the mind, becoming much more flexible and free and open. So this has happened to me. No one wanted to talk to me during the last walking period, or very few. So I was sitting here and nothing to do, and so I thought, well, everybody's walking, so I guess I'll go out and walk. So I was doing a walking meditation out there. And you know, giving a Dharma talk, giving a talk, you know, isn't something which I'm completely non-abiding about. So I was out there thinking about this talk, you know, and I kept noticing my mind kept going thinking about this talk, and I could feel a certain kind of tightness, a certain kind of little bit. It wasn't so dramatic, maybe a little bit of anxiety about the talk. But I was doing the walking practice, trying to be as attentive as I can in the present moment, noticing when it was my mind would go off into these, you know, thinking about the talk. And when it did that, I would try to catch it when it first arose, and just being aware of it there, and then I'd come back. And then what happened again, and I'd come back. And after a while doing the walking out there, I started feeling a kind of flexibility arose within me, that the mind stopped wanting to go away so much, and the mind started feeling more spacious and more calm, more open. Because I wasn't giving in, I wasn't allowing myself to, I don't know if this is the right way of talking about it, but I wasn't, I was attentive enough to catch myself, to notice when I was caught by a preoccupation. So it wasn't that I was trying to stop myself from being preoccupied. It wasn't like I was aversive to it. However, I was trying to notice the moment, or as early as I could, when it was that I was caught by something. And because I was relatively settled, the noticing itself freed me up. And it was easy then to come back. Or it wasn't so strong, my preoccupation, just simply coming back was easy enough to do. Is this making sense? Trying to describe my inner life. So investigation is not thinking or analyzing or contemplating anything. It's letting the light of awareness shine on our experience with an inquiring impulse, an inquiring sense. There's a poem in that they recite at the San Francisco Zen Center several mornings a week. And the poem, one line in the poem says, goes, it, and it is supposed to be, in this poem, is thusness, is ultimate reality as it is, things as they are. The participatory reality we always live in. It responds to the inquiring impulse. So reality responds to the inquiring impulse. So the movement to inquiry, to investigate, is a movement not to be stuck. It's a movement to allow ourselves to open up. And that something happens. The world responds to that inquiry. And now how it responds, I don't know. Maybe it's better not to say. But the world that we live in is actually a participatory world. And investigation is not a passive activity, but actually it changes the whole participatory game that we're in. The name of the temple name of the San Francisco Zen Center is Beginner's Mind Temple. And most of you know the famous book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. It was an expression that Suzuki Roshi liked, Beginner's Mind. And I think that part of the reason that Suzuki Roshi liked the name, the word, is that in a beginner's mind, there's a lot of possibilities. When someone who's an expert, it said, you know, might some, this doesn't, you know, don't push this analogy too far. You'll find that it doesn't always work. But someone who kind of is an expert has these preconceived ideas, perhaps. And so doesn't see all the varieties of ways that we can possibly respond to a situation. Like waiting until the siren goes by. So, so I guess a beginner's mind is a mind which doesn't have preconceived ideas, but has an infinite amount, perhaps, or many different options to respond. Doesn't have any fixed way of responding. And in that sense, mindfulness practice is a practice of trying to have a beginner's mind. To have a mind which doesn't know what's supposed to be happening, doesn't know what's, doesn't have some fixed category that it's trying to put the practice in, or fixed direction it's trying to get in, but rather is open to all possibilities, any possibility. And the idea that I have is that it's the openness to possibility which is the point, not the possibilities you fill that openness with. And you might fill it different ways at different times, but it's the openness to possibilities which is really the non-abiding nirvana of the Buddhas. And the last thing I'll say along this line, and one of the reasons why I think investigation is important, and why I think also it's a natural impulse of the mind that's free, that's settled on itself, is that my understanding is that life is an open system, and that any kind of system, any kind of belief system, any kind of fixed ideas we have about how things are, any kind of fixed experience we have, we think this is it. There's always something beyond that fixed system. There's always something outside of that particular belief system or that particular explanation or that particular analysis. And as long as there's something outside of it, there's a natural tendency, I believe, to be curious what's out there, or to want to go beyond that, or not be limited by these particular limitations that we have, this particular belief system. And so, investigation is what carries us into this greater possibility of the unknown. Because what's outside any kind of belief system, any kind of system of understanding, is unknown. And so mindfulness, in a sense, moves us, carries us into an unknown. And which isn't always so comfortable, because we'd rather have a spiritual life that told us, you know, where it was, where it's at. Wouldn't it be great if you knew where it was at? Then you can go tell your friends where it's at, and then you know, they would think you're really hot because you knew where it was at. But rather you're doing a spiritual practice that doesn't tell you where it's at all. And you don't know where it's at. And so you can't tell anyone you know where it's at. And so the same poem that says it responds to the inquiring impulse, I think it's the same poem. It's another poem they chant. And it ends by saying, practice like a fool, like an idiot. Well, gee. That's not what I got involved with this stuff for. I wanted to be someone special, you know. There's, you know, Vipassana is kind of in fashion, you know. You know, you get to do the right thing, it's fashionable these days. Be like a fool, like an idiot. Well, gee. So they inquire, to look around, what's going on here, what is going on here, not to settle in anything. My suggestion for you to think about is that whenever you feel bummed out in any way, whenever you feel, not whenever, because sometimes it's, you know, chemical factors playing out within us. But many times when we feel angry about something or depressed about something or whatever, that what's happened is that we are abiding in something. Maybe some evaluation, some kind of resistance, some kind of judgment, some kind of idea of what's what and what's right. And that to begin exploring the non-abiding nature of the mind is actually to begin finding that it's very difficult to stay angry or depressed or whatever, because it's difficult then to hang on to that one particular evaluation, which is really the core of it, at the root of it. Now that is a big, you know, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't have dropped that as a bombshell at the very end. That's a, you know, that's something for you just to explore and investigate with a beginner's mind, if it's true for yourself. It's really fascinating and really beautiful when mindfulness begins picking up speed by itself. Mindfulness is simply the act of noticing what's happening in the present moment, allowing things to be as they are, noticing what they're happening. And as our ability to notice becomes quicker and more precise, you know, just noticing what's happening, it's very hard. Quicker it becomes, the more it's there moment by moment, the harder it is to abide any place. And the harder it is to abide any place, the freer the beginner mind becomes. And the more, paradoxically, the calmer and more equanimous the mind becomes. The mind which is noticing and has the energy to notice moment by moment actually becomes more at ease. Initially, it might feel like it's kind of, as you're learning how to do mindfulness, it might seem like this noticing is kind of like effortful and, you know, trying and kind of exhausting to do. But actually, as you learn to do it, it becomes more and more easeful thing to do, because what isn't easeful is to be preoccupied. Right? Initially, being preoccupied might be more easeful than making the effort to be mindful. But as the mindfulness becomes stronger and builds up speed, it shades or moves into a more easeful way of being. And so as the flexibility, as the openness to possibility becomes stronger, a tremendous amount of equanimity develops. Equanimity is not the point. So what is the point? So what do you think? Now it's your turn. Yes.
Compared to August, when the mind wanders, be part of your conducting an investigation.
It could be. It's possible. Sometimes it is. People, mind wanders away, and you're wondering about this conversation you had earlier in the day. What did that person really mean when they said that? But underlying, perhaps in that kind of situation might be anxiety about what the person really meant. And so, the place that the person's stuck, that kind of investigation, where we're abiding, is in the anxiety. So, I don't know. I'm not going to tell you, what's what. But my tendency is to believe is that when it's preoccupied wandering away, that there's usually some place we're abiding. And so, what becomes interesting in mindfulness, well, first of all, mindfulness is we want to allow for that. So the most important thing in mindfulness is first to allow for what you experience, allow for yourself being distracted, allow for yourself being wandering, allow yourself to be as you are. Don't have a spiritual practice which says, I can't be where I am right now. I have to get more, I have to be more free, I have to be more enlightened, I have to be more calm, I have to be more mindful. Forget about that. Start with the allowing. And then with that allowing, then what we do is we add the mindfulness to that. Does that make sense? And then we start discovering what's actually going on here. And mindfulness is simply just recognizing what's going on. Investigation is to do that with a little bit more oomph, a little bit more energy, a little bit more questioning, looking a little bit, not probing, but looking more closely, getting closer to what's going on. So your knee hurts. You know it hurts. That's being mindful. Investigation is to really go in there and find out, what is pain in the knee really like? And if you look really carefully, you find that the word pain is just a generic kind of rough label. And you get in there, and it's a universe of different sensations. There's sensations of heat and sparking and pulling and twisting and tightening and stabbing and searing and all kinds of things. And so the investigation is going to finding out what's actually going on there. Yeah. It's not that. It's just looking more. Just looking more. Look, just kind of in the present moment to what's actually happening. Can I look more carefully? What's happening? Can I take a closer look at this? Often in the body. Depends on what's appropriate, but often in the body. So if there's fear you said. So if there's fear, it's not reflectively think back. Why am I afraid or what's going on here? But rather look more carefully, what is the experience of fear like for you? So you know you're afraid. Now you ask, what is the experience of fear like for me? Oh, I feel it as these kinds of sensations in my body. Oh, sensations in the body. So now you're mindful of these sensations. You can hang out with that. Now what are these sensations really like if I look really carefully at them? Well, actually, they're mostly on the surface of my chest, not deep down. And actually, it isn't just kind of a general sense of tightness all over, but if I look carefully, I find that actually it's a tight band across the center of my chest. And if I look even more closely, I find out where the strongest is that it's right in the center. So I'm going to hang out there. It doesn't really make sense to maybe look more closely at the tightness, but I'm going to hang out in that little spot for a while and see what happens. And part of the investigation is to notice what happens as you stay attentive. Oh, if I stay attentive and watch this, I find out it actually, as tightness gets stronger and more unpleasant. Isn't that interesting? So then you stay with that. You stay with that. And then you find that it moves, and the tightness moves down to kind of into your pit of your stomach. That's interesting. It's moved now. Now mostly I'm feeling this real tight ball in the center of my stomach. And then you say, well, what's this about? Not, what's under this and what's the cause of that, but what's this really like? Oh, it comes with a lot of feel. As part of this is feeling of rage. Wow, I didn't know I had all this rage. Wow, this rage, and then you allow the rage to be there. Wow, And you don't have to do any investigation because there's lots of energy. And then you kind of look carefully at, you know, so you're there, and after a while it kind of settles or changes, and you kind of look carefully in the, what else is going on here? So rather than asking what's the cause of this, I said, what else is going on here? You know, I've looked at the rage for a while, what else is going on here? Or if I looked at this particular experience for a while, what else is going on here? And then you might see in the corners of it, in the cracks of it, you might see something else. You might see that in the corner of anger, maybe you'll see, find vulnerability. And so that's interesting. So let me allow and explore the vulnerability, investigate that a little bit. What is that like? Where do I feel that in the body? What happens if I open to it? And then you might find a tenderness. And then the tenderness might open to a feeling of calm. And all, you know, it all started with fear. And you weren't looking for something, but you kind of follow this, you know, kind of investigating what actually is here, what else is going on here. Is that helpful or? They were coming back. Well, in that situation, you might avoid looking at it in the body, and you might just not look in the body, but hang out with it for a while as the non-embodied parts of it, and just so you get to know it better. Just what is it like to be angry outside the body? Well, you know, if this is a common phenomena for you, that certain kind of emotion like fear comes up, and it's relatively easy for you to let go of it because you can look at it, the body, just pay attention to it. And for whatever reason, it kind of wanders away quickly. And it keeps reoccurring over and over again. Then maybe what you want to do is play with the stories. and you might want to investigate the stories a little bit. And it might be something in psychoanalysis they call this hovering awareness. But hovering, you might hover with the story a little bit. Maybe in the interface, if you can, between letting go of it and staying with it, kind of oscillating, but right there, seeing if you can get a different perspective on it, and see what, you know, investigate it from a different point of view and what else might be going on. Investigate, tell you all the stories you want. And then investigate the tone of the voice, which is telling the story. But if you go to use the ATM machine, and there's some fellow, you know, with a semi-automatic rifle kind of hanging out nearby. You know, you might want to kind of consider for a little bit before, you know, what's going on here? And, you know, a semi-automatic rifle, I'm going to get my ATM, I want my money, and what's going on? Is this really, you know, the right time to get my money? And then you notice that actually, you know, the ATM machine is right next to a police station. And this is just a police guy. He's kind of just loading his, he's supposed to have. You know, that's his job, is to have a semi-automatic rifle. And, you know, he's not, you know, he's a safe guy, he's a nice guy, and he's, you know, talking to his boss after all, and he's not, you know, it's probably safe to go use the ATM machine. So I agree with you. And part of what mindfulness is to know when it's appropriate to do different things. And however, to be fixated on something, be attached and preoccupied, is different than thinking carefully about what needs to be done. And there are times when thinking is very important. I like to go for a walk or go running. And that's a time where I like to think a lot. When I need to think about something in my life, that's a great time to do that. And when my cushion, I don't try to do that kind of thinking. However, I know that when I'm preoccupied and stuck by something, I might not even have the wherewithal to even know when I need to think about something appropriately. So if I'm completely preoccupied by something and I show up at the ATM machine, I might not even notice my environment around me. So am I responding to your concern? So I think your concern, if I can summarize it perhaps, arises out of the idea or that mindfulness, the way we talk about mindfulness is to have a kind of non-discursive awareness that doesn't really consider things thoughtfully. There's a place for that kind of awareness, but that's not the point of mindfulness. The point of mindfulness, again, is the flexibility that comes when we're not stuck on any particular place. And if you're not stuck, then you can know when it's appropriate to think about something and when it's appropriate to not to. And if the situation is the child in the street is about to be run over, if you're not preoccupied and stuck, I think that, hopefully, you'll just respond like that. One of the beautiful things we saw this was when I used to live in the San Francisco Zen Center, the meditation hall is in the basement of the building, and it borders a street on one side and an alley on the other side. And we would get up and sit at 5 o'clock in the morning. And it was right near, it was kind of like the ghettos of San Francisco, kind of near the projects, and there's a lot of drugs and prostitution and muggings and killings and robbings and drive-by shootings and you name it, you know, it happened in that neighborhood. And so we'd be sitting there in the morning and always, you know, interesting sounds out in the street. And, you know, cars would be broken into, crash, you hear the glass breaking, and fire trucks and muggings and, you know, fights and prostitutes doing their business on the other side of the wall. And, you know, all this stuff going on, you're sitting there. Mostly, you know, you sit there meditating, you know, it's like all these sounds. But when it was something that required action, like someone's being mugged, it was really dramatic to see these Zen students. It was like, it was no hesitation. They leaped, bounded out of their seats, and they're out the door and out down the alley after the situation, take care of it. And it was somehow, the sense you had was that they were sitting there and they were so present in the present moment that they were ready to respond for whatever the situation required of them in that in that moment. And if someone was suddenly yelling for help, there was no hesitation. They just, off they went. Sometimes it was foolish. I remember once a whole bunch of you ran out, because you never knew, you know, what was out there. So it was really beautiful they would go out. But I remember once rushing, you know, dashing out the door, and I was in the far end of the meditation hall, so I was one of the last people out. So everybody else was running down Page Street. And after some, you know, person who had taken a purse. And I guess the woman who lost her purse was on the top of Page Street saying, he went that away. So everybody went running down the street. So I was coming out late. I was one of the last people to come out. And so I didn't feel it was too much point to kind of run after this big crowd of people. So I kind of was walking and I kind of noticed, something told me that's to go and look in what was happening in those bushes there. And there's these big bushes halfway down the street. And I was a Zen monk, you know, priest, and I had a shaved head and I wore these black robes. And I, you know, to someone who's uninitiated, it probably looked like Kung Fu. And so I kind of was sort of walking over, you know, to this, you know, I'm completely meek, you know, I don't know anything about fighting or anything, you know, and I'm kind of a weak guy. And so here, and this guy jumps out of the bushes and puts his hand up against the wall of his garage. You know, I didn't do it or whatever, you know, holding his purse. I didn't do it. Or whatever he said, don't do it, you know. Just. And he was completely terrified of me. And so... So there were some other people who were coming, and so we kind of got around him and circled him, you know, and he tricked us and got away anyway. But what he did, he didn't have the purse. What happened was he said, "I'm going to take you. I'll show you where the purse is." He said, "I'll show you where the purse is. Don't call the police. I'll take you where the purse is." And so he went around the corner. There was a little park next to it. It was by the Zen Center Hospice, if you know. And so there was a park next to it, a little park. And he was in the park there. And so we had this half circle around him, and he was against the wall. He's kind of walking along. And what happens with a half circle, and you come to a corner. the person's not surrounded anymore. And he took off. And as he took off, he picked up the purse and ran down the street and disappeared. And he was faster than all of us. And later, I realized, you know, that the guy could have had a gun. And here I was walking up to this person, you know, how smart was it to walk up to these bushes like that? So maybe I should have done some reflective thinking. I was too caught up with my adrenaline and all, maybe, too. So I hope that the mindfulness makes us more responsive in all the ways we need to be responsive. And if action is what's required, I hope that what mindfulness has taught us is how not to be stuck in our inhibitions. If we are inhibited to act or afraid to act, that we have enough mindfulness and presence to see that, to not be caught by those, so we're prevented from acting properly. So this woman some years ago who was asked, you know, she was going to be a teacher of Vipassana, and she was asked, you know, what do you have to teach? What's the most important thing you have to teach? And she said, empowerment. If I had one word, it would be the word empowerment. And I thought that was kind of weird, because my word was acceptance. You know, how do you put these two together? And I thought about it for a while, and I realized that they're two sides of the same coin. And that if you allow properly, and that it also empowers you, because then you can act from within as is appropriate more freely. If the child's out in the street, you'll act. So I hope that mindfulness practice makes us people who are not only more allowing, but also more responsive and engaged with the world around us. Long answer for your simple question. And I said we would sit. It's already 4:30, so if you don't mind, so I can follow through on what I said, why don't we sit for 30 seconds? It's a nice way of ending. Part of the allowing part of practice is not to be too concerned about doing it right. And another part of the allowing aspect of practice is to be tremendously compassionate about yourself and not to be idealistic about your spiritual practice. Be compassionate and allowing for who you are. So may whatever benefits and merit we've had from this day of practice together, may it be shared with the people we meet today and tomorrow, and may it travel out and touch others so that all beings may be happy. May all beings everywhere be happy. Thank you all, and I want to remind you about the two Dana baskets. And the reason I want to remind you is that I'm going to share some of my Dana with Terry, who did the yoga this morning. I think it's a nice thing to do to support her, and she was part of the retreat teaching it. So it's nice for you all to know that if you want to make a donation to Terry, that I'm going to pass it on to her. And if you didn't leave a donation for the rent donation is optional, but it's less optional. A little bit less optional, because it's helpful if we all help pay for our expenses of putting this day on. So the smaller the boxes there is for the $5 for rent Donna. So, and then the next day we do a one-day sitting is May 10th. And it's 8:30 to 5, and it's one of the ones that I don't talk at all throughout the day. It's just for experienced people. There's no instruction given. And it's a wonderful day of quiet. And then for some people, there's a sign-up sheet. And if you want to have a short interview with me, 15-minute interview, you can put your name on the sheet, and I'm available for interviews on those days. So, thank you all, and good night.